The headlines: at least 10 Afghan civilians, including 6 children, are killed in a U.S. drone strike in Kabul. The Taliban say that they will seek friendly ties with all countries around the world once a government is established in Afghanistan. Also in the headlines, Tehran says Washington is in no position to prevent its fuel supply to Lebanon, which is suffering from a severe energy crisis. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. It's good to have you with us. This is news. At least 10 civilians, including 6 children, are killed in a U.S. drone strike in the Afghan capital, Kabul. That is according to the relatives of the victims. The deaths occurred after a car parked inside of a home was struck by a U.S. drone on Sunday. Earlier, Taliban spokesman Zabihullah Mujahid confirmed 7 deaths in the strike. He condemned Washington's action unlawful, saying that the U.S. should have informed the Taliban before launching such an attack. Meanwhile, several rockets were fired at Kabul International Airport, but were intercepted by a missile defense system. The Daesh terror group has claimed responsibility for the rocket fire. The developments come as the U.S. is racing against time to complete its withdrawal from Afghanistan. Journalist and political analyst Brian Biletich says that the chaos in Afghanistan is the result of 20 years of U.S. military presence there.
This is 20 years of U.S. foreign policy in Afghanistan unraveling before everyone's eyes. They're claiming that they're leaving Afghanistan because they have accomplished their mission of preventing the country from being used as a safe haven for terrorism. And at the same time, they're claiming ISIS or Daesh is attacking them as they're withdrawing. So obviously that's not true. They are conducting these over-the-horizon drone strikes that are most likely flying out of either Qatar or the United Arab Emirates. Both of these countries have been identified by the U.S. as state sponsors of terrorism, including of Daesh or ISIS. So everything we're seeing now in Afghanistan, it looks chaotic because this is 20 years of lies unraveling. And the U.S. cannot cover up what they've done there any longer.
The Taliban say that they will seek friendly ties with all countries around the world once a government is established in Afghanistan. Taliban spokesman Zabihullah Mujahid said that the worries, concerns that some countries have, can be resolved through diplomacy. Mujahid called on the U.S. and other Western countries not to stand in their way. He also noted that the group is serious about forming a government as soon as possible. Mujahid said once foreign troops leave the country, no terror group, including Daesh, will have any excuse to operate on Afghan soil. Tehran says the U.S. and other countries are in no position to block the legitimate fuel trade between Iran and Lebanon. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman says that the choice of the country to which Tehran sells its oil and its fuel is a sovereign issue. Saeed Khatibzadeh stressed that such legitimate trade is a clear international right of any nation, and that Iran is very serious in exercising its sovereignty. Iran has dispatched a third fuel ship into Lebanon to help ease the country's energy crisis, which Hezbollah blames on U.S. sanctions. Israeli sources say the resistance movement is on alert to react to any hostile move by the regime against the Lebanon-bound Iranian tanker after it entered the Mediterranean. Iran's foreign minister is in the Syrian capital, Damascus. Following his trip to Iraq, Hossein Amir Abdullahian says the presence of foreign forces will not contribute to sustainable security and stability in the region. Our correspondent Muhammad Ali reports.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian arrived in Damascus on Sunday. He sat down with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and discussed with him steps taken by both sides to enhance bilateral cooperation with the aim of reaching a higher level of partnership in economy and trade. In the meeting, Assad reaffirmed that the ongoing cooperation between the two countries had positive results in terms of protecting the interests of the two peoples, mainly in fighting terrorism. Abdullahian, for his part, briefed Assad on the outcome of the Baghdad Cooperation and Partnership Conference. He asserted that Iran will continue to support Syria in fighting all forms of terror, mainly economic terrorism.
Both countries are working on a roadmap to develop relations as well as trade and economic cooperation to tackle the sanctions imposed on them. We discussed the latest developments in the region. Improving economic cooperation between both countries' private sector is an important issue which both sides regard as crucial.
The Iranian official also held a separate meeting with his Syrian counterpart Faisal al-Maqdad. They discussed regional and international developments, saying that foreign presence in the region will not bring security and stability. Maqdad underlined the importance of steadfastness in the face of all Western plots and pressure in order to achieve victory.
We discussed bilateral relations, the situation in Syria and Iran, as well as mutual challenges, the steadfastness of Syria and Iran, as well as all those who want to achieve justice, freedom, sovereignty and independence in our world. We lead them to victory over terrorism and those who question our capability to face challenges.
Abdullahian concluded his meetings by holding talks with heads of Syria-based Palestinian factions, renewing Iran's support for Palestinians' struggle and their fight for their legitimate rights. Mr. Abdullahian's visit comes shortly after the formation of the new cabinet in Iran. The visit is a reiteration of Iran's steadfast stance towards Syria, based on support to the government and people in the fight on terror and for rebuilding the country. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
The World Health Organization warns about another 236,000 COVID-19-related deaths in Europe by December the 1st.
Several countries are starting to observe an increased burden on hospitals and more deaths. Last week, there was an 11% increase in the number of deaths in the region, with one reliable projection expecting 236,000 deaths in Europe by December 1st.
The WHO's European director said 33 states in Europe have registered a death rate of over 10% in the last 2 weeks. Hans Kluge described the high transmission rates across the continent as deeply worrying. He attributed the rise in infections on the more contagious Delta variant, the easing of restrictions, and a surge in summer travel. Kluge noted that even though around half of Europe's population is fully inoculated, vaccination uptake in the region has slowed down. He said the decline in vaccination is of serious concern, while urging countries to increase production and sharing of vaccines. Official figures show that Germany's annual consumer price inflation has jumped to its highest level since 2008. The German Federal Statistical Office said consumer prices rose by 3.4% in August, compared with 3.1% in July. This comes as Europe's largest economy is reeling from the fallout of the coronavirus pandemic, with companies struggling with supply shortages. Experts believe the current increase in Germany's consumer prices is likely to remain temporary. However, the German Central Bank has warned that inflation could hover above 2% until mid-2022. Iran has inaugurated the largest COVID vaccination center in its east. The new medical facility was built as the country is scrambling to contain the unabated surge of the coronavirus death toll. Yusuf Jalali reports from Mashhad.
This is the so far largest COVID vaccination center in east of Iran. Based in the northeastern city of Mashhad, the medical facility has the capacity to inoculate a whopping 10,000 people every day. The privately owned facility was launched with the attendance of state officials in Mashhad.
This facility offers the space and infrastructure needed to conduct the vaccination. The vaccines and vaccinators will be provided by the health ministry.
Iran has so far vaccinated roughly 7 million people. That's less than 10% of the population. This as the resurgence of the coronavirus in more lethal forms like the Delta variant has been killing an average of 500 Iranians every day. The new Iranian administration, led by President Raisi, has vowed to import millions of vaccines in the coming months. And Parliament says it's ready to offer any help to achieve this goal. In addition to the import of foreign vaccines, Iran is also trying to ramp up the production of domestically made jabs, such as Coviran, which has so far injected more than 1.5 million doses in the country. Nura and Covbars are among the local vaccines that are expected to hit the market in the next few months.
Figures show that every 3 minutes, one Iranian dies of the coronavirus. And this is not the peak yet. Now, as vaccination is viewed as the ultimate terminator of the pandemic, Iran says it will build more such vaccination centers across the country. to speed up the so far sluggish inoculation trend in Iran. Yusuf Jalali from the Holy City of Mashhad.
Israeli forces have demolished yet another Palestinian home in the occupied territory. Bulldozers, backed by Israeli troops, destroyed a house in Jabal Mukaber village in East Al-Quds. This is the latest in a series of demolitions carried out by Israeli forces in the occupied territories in recent days. Israel demolishes Palestinian homes and structures on a regular basis, citing different pretexts, including the lack of a construction permit. Palestinians and rights groups say that the demolitions are aimed at grabbing more land for Israeli settlement expansions. Palestinian resistance groups in the Gaza Strip have lashed out at President Mahmoud Abbas for meeting with the Israeli Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz. The Hamas described the move as a stab in the back of Palestinians, saying that Abbas has abandoned national values. The resistance movement called for a united front against such humiliating behavior. Another group, the Islamic Jihad Movement, also slammed the meeting, saying that the Palestinian president is boosting ties with the enemy. Abbas and Gantz met on Sunday in the West Bank city of Ramallah. The two discussed a number of issues, including security and economic situations in the occupied West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip. Clashes have erupted between Israeli forces and Palestinians near the separation barrier with the Gaza Strip. A number of Palestinians were injured as a result. During our news review program, we discussed the issue with our guests. Let's take a listen.
It's time now for the news review section. Do stay with us. Israeli forces have violently clashed with Palestinians protesting near the so-called buffer zone in the Gaza Strip against years of Israeli siege of that territory. Nearly 20 Palestinians got injured after the regime forces attacked protesters who were venting their anger by burning tires and chanting anti-Israel slogans. Some protesters also threw stones and Molotov cocktails at Israeli forces. Demonstrators said that they would continue their protests until the regime lifted its crippling blockade on the people of Gaza. At least 11 Palestinians were injured in similar protests on Saturday after Israeli forces resorted to live fire in tear gas. Gaza has been under a tight Israeli air and sea blockade since 2007. The siege and several Israeli wars have destroyed the Gaza economy. In 2018, people there launched a protest movement demanding an end to Israel's blockade and the right for Palestinians to return to the land they were forcibly expelled from after the creation of Israel in 1948. Now let's get some information and insight on this. So joining me will be a couple of guests. We'll have our correspondent, Ashraf Shannon, in Gaza City. We'll also be joined by Mustafa Barghouti, who is with Palestine Liberation Organization Central Council in Ramallah. Good to have you both on the show. Let's go to Gaza City to Ashraf and to get an update regarding the latest going on the ground there, Ashraf, and all the issues and problems that the people in Gaza are facing in the presence of this blockade that has been there. And also recently we have this escalation of violence against Palestinians.
Yes, Behrouz, the Israeli regime forces yesterday injured close to 24 Palestinians protesting in the east of the northern Gaza Strip refugee camp of Jabalia. While over the last 2 weeks, Israeli forces killed two protesters, including a 12-year-old boy. This is what's happening nowadays in the Gaza Strip, close to the so-called buffer zone in the east of the enclave, is similar to the Great March of Return peaceful rallies that began on March 30th, 2018. To demand the right of return for millions of Palestinian refugees and the complete lifting of the Israeli blockade. During those peaceful protests, Israeli forces killed some 300 protesters, including medics and also journalists. Israel continues to use excessive force against peaceful protesters. For example, that 12-year-old boy who was shot two weeks ago, he was shot in the neck by a live bullet and succumbed to his wounds a week later.
Now let's turn to Ramallah, Mr. Barghouti. Palestinians need to be meeting each other, and we're expecting that to happen because since a year ago they were talking about putting aside their differences and uniting. What's happened to that?
What happened is that after we met and agreed on three major things. One is to establish a unified national leadership for the Palestinian Popular Nonviolent Resistance, and we agreed on having elections, presidential elections, legislative council elections, and elections for the Palestinian National Council. Unfortunately, later the PA cancelled all of that. The national unified national leadership was not established really, and the Popular Nonviolent Resistance was not adopted fully as it should. But the more important thing is that the Palestinian Authority and the President cancelled the elections. And by cancelling the elections, he practically cancelled all the results of the dialogue that we had together. That's why I think going back to unity requires three major conditions. One is an acceptance of the principle of democratic participation of all Palestinian groups without exception. Second is to bring back the elections and establish an immediate date for the elections to take place, including in Jerusalem, despite Israeli obstruction. And third, that the Palestinian Authority should say clearly that they are ready for a new strategy, a new platform that does not make build hopes only on negotiations and on Oslo agreement, but on enhancing the Palestinian struggle for its rights against occupation and against the system of apartheid and discrimination.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Ashraf Shannon in Gaza City and Mustafa Barghouti with Palestine Liberation Organization Central Council in Ramallah joined us with their comments and contribution. That's it for this edition of the News Review.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Economic divide.
The story of Afghanistan has been front page news for quite some time, and rightly so. In one respect, it shows how waging a war, occupation, and a retreat can destroy a country. And that is what the U.S. and its NATO partners have done. Hi, I'm Kavitah Wai, and in this edition of Economic Divide, we will look at Afghanistan's economy and where it's going to be headed to next, what's left of it, under the Taliban. The exorbitant U.S. spending in the Afghan war, $2.26 trillion. Corruption, waste, unfinished projects, and an expense that will continue for quite some time, even after the U.S. pullout. That's in the form of interests. Was it worth it? Also, we're going to take a look at the Afghan economy under the Taliban. What was the economy before they took control? And what will be their source of revenues? Will they discontinue their opium sales? Our in-depth section will cover that. And then we will take a look at what Afghanistan prides itself in terms of its product and commodity, and that is its wealth minerals. China has practically welcomed the Taliban with open arms. Is that due to the One Belt, One Road project, or with an eye on Afghanistan's mineral wealth?
The U.S. war in Afghanistan has ended after 20 years. The U.S. president justified his withdrawal.
I stand squarely behind my decision. After 20 years, I've learned the hard way.
The current cost, to date, $2.261 trillion. This is the breakdown. The DoD, largest spending, $933 billion. The interest, a staggering $530 billion, something the U.S. has to continue paying even after the war has ended. But what does the U.S. have to show for it? Iskal Sagar, Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, created by U.S. Congress to provide independent and objective oversight of Afghanistan reconstruction projects and activities. Report after report, the naked truth was revealed. Shocking. Corruption and waste were rampant. The latest report confirmed more or less what the previous reports revealed. Titled, What We Need to Learn, Lessons from 20 Years of Afghanistan Reconstruction, it concluded the U.S. failed to implement a coherent strategy in over 20 years. It did not understand the Afghan context and failed to tailor its efforts accordingly. We were devoid of a fundamental understanding. We did not know what we were doing. Many of the institutions and infrastructure projects the U.S. had built were not sustainable or even usable.
To me, it's billions of dollars that probably have been wasted. We've built schools that are falling down. We've built clinics that there are no doctors for. We've built roads that are falling apart.
Some examples of this waste. Tarakhil Power Plant, $335 million. Used but not as intended, and in a deteriorated condition. The Wardak National Police Training Center, $98 million. Used as intended, but deteriorated. The most critical failure, the Afghan Army. $88.3 billion spent for training and equipping.
When you take a look at the Afghan economy, it wasn't a functioning economy based on, for example, supply and demand. There were other factors which spurred economic activity. Now, Afghanistan is extremely poor, landlocked, and highly dependent on foreign aid. Corruption, insecurity, weak governance, lack of infrastructure pose challenges to future economic growth. The Afghan economy sustained nearly a decade of strong growth, international assistance, which pledged around $86.8 billion. The country's gross domestic product, estimated at $22 billion, has grown nearly threefold since the Taliban were driven from power back in 2001. According to the World Bank, three-fourths of the government's budget is funded by international donors. Well, the state of the economy, even with international assistance, was so weak that 90% of the population lives on less than $2 a day. That's according to the former president, Ashraf Ghani. Our guest joining us for this edition of the program, in this segment, is Mohammad Daoud Avedi. He's the chairman of the Afghan Nation Peace Council. He was previously a spokesman and a negotiator for the Hizb Islami group. Okay, welcome, Mohammad Daoud. You are aware about the situation as it's unfolding in Afghanistan. Since the year 2001, the U.S. has spent, it's estimated, $2.226 trillion. That has yielded a chaotic, humiliating end to America's longest war, because really the money is under question as to where it went. Corruption has been stated from both the U.S. and Afghan side. You have unfinished projects. So the question is, where did this money go? Why did that not get spent wisely in that country?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thank you for your invitation. The money that U.S. and other nations spent in Afghanistan were split in different ways, and was spent in different ways. Some were, most big chunk of it were spent for military purposes, their own military, to come and fight the Afghans. It was not for the rebuild of Afghanistan or building structures in Afghanistan that could benefit the Afghan people in Afghanistan as a whole. A very big chunk of this was spent through the war. But the portion that was spent through the Afghan government and the NGOs, non-government organizations, that money that was spent in these two sectors was split again into two. Some were given to the NGOs and some were given to the Afghan government.
Okay, we appreciate that. Thank you, Mohammad Daoud, for that. Now, as you indicated, their money was misused and misappropriated, and nothing is more evident of that in this case in point, than what was called Afghanistan's ghost money. Now, this ghost money is in reference to a tactic that was used by the CIA to get money to Afghanistan. It's time now for our info news section, where we take a look at news which may not be that up to date, but worth taking a look at, especially for one of our future programs. Our first story comes out of Haiti. Haiti was hit by a massive earthquake recently, which devastated parts of the island. In terms of the casualty figures, over 1,200 lives were lost. This comes after the assassination of its president, and as a consequence, now the economy has taken a beating. Haiti, with a population of 11 million, is considered the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. Next story, U.S.-China trade. Haven't taken a look at that in a while. When it comes to trade tensions between the two, the U.S. better think twice about how much pressure it's exerting on China. The U.S.-China trade war is hurting America more than actually China. Trump's unprecedented tariffs and technology war with China, which is now passed on to Biden, is costing the U.S. economy, causing disruption to crucial supply chains and wild swings in prices overall. Next up, fake drugs, counterfeit drugs. They've always been a problem. One report revealed fake medicine now kills upwards of the figure that you're about to see here, which is quite astounding when you think about it in terms of the deaths. 1 million people, that's per year. Wonder how much that is every day. It's quite a bit. That's according to the World Health Organization. And that's five times actually more people that die than narcotics. I mean, the trade in fake drugs has proliferated so much during COVID that it has eclipsed the market which has cocaine, heroin, and cannabis in it. So that's leading to more deaths than those illegal drugs. And our final look is at U.S. food stamps. This program in the U.S., the U.S. president just announced the biggest increase to the food stamps ever. Starting in October, food assistance benefits will increase by an average, which is one of its largest in its history, if not the largest, 25%. So the people receiving the food assistance are going to be happy to hear that. Our average benefit, which was $121 before COVID, will now increase by $36 a month. Sounds good, but is it because the economy is not doing well for many Americans? Something to think about. Okay, it's time now for a quick break here on Economic Divide, but we'll be right back after a quick pause.
You're listening to Economic Divide. This series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
It's time now for our in-depth section. Now that the Taliban have overtaken Afghanistan, how are they going to make sure that they have an operational economy? Well, these are some of the questions that sooner rather than later they have to deal with. For example, how are they going to run a finance ministry and also a central bank? Central bank is obviously very key. As of now, the U.S. has actually blocked close to $9 billion of its money overseas. They're not going to let the Taliban access it. So that's going to be a very key question. Next up, how will foreign donors actually be able to trust them with aid? Now, the aid for Afghanistan is something that happens on a yearly basis. Many countries around the world contribute to Afghanistan because, obviously, it's a country that's been racked with wars, years of wars. So that's a very key question there also. And then the next question, since many of them are sanctioned, many Taliban members, how will they access the world financial system? I mean, that's really important. They need to transfer money. They need to have money coming in. How is that going to happen? I mean, as of this point, there isn't a system of governance in place in that country yet, at least as of the recording of this program. However, this is what a senior Taliban leader, his name is Wahidullah Hashemi, has said.
In future, this is not up to now discussed how it would be. Maybe we have a council, the head of the council, as you call the president, we would call that Rais al-Wazara or the head of the council, and we will have ministers. All the ministers would be appointed by this council and by the head of the council.
Well, that's what he has said. Well, to begin with, generating income is going to be very important to the Taliban. That answer may come in the form of what is called the informal economy. Now, the informal economy has large amounts of hidden money in the war zone. First off, opiates, as you see here, trafficking in opium, hashish, methamphetamines, and other narcotics is set to bring the Taliban revenues of anywhere between $500 to $600 million yearly. Not bad, is it? Now, since they came to power, they have vowed not to continue this illegal trade. But the biggest kind of trade that happens, the real money, comes from another area that is not that well known. That is money which comes from the illegal movement of ordinary goods. Now, it consists of things like fuel and also consumer imports. So these are the goods that are flowing in through this, what we call informal economy, which is the illegal movement of goods in this case. In size and sum, the informal economy dwarfs international aid, which again flows into Afghanistan on a yearly basis. Now, let's take a look at that source of income, which is called the informal taxation. You have the informal economy and then the formal taxation. Fees for passage of goods is what I'm talking about here. This is the collection of fees by armed personnel, the Taliban, to allow safe passage of the goods. The money produced from this taxation, $235 million annually. Now, one of the largest income producers came from an area by the name of Zaranj. That's actually a city bordering Iran. Now, this city provided the government with roughly, again, these are rough numbers, $43.2 million in terms of annual duties. Also, an additional $50 million in direct taxes for the year 2020. There was also a significant amount of undeclared trade, particularly of fuel. Total revenues from this border crossing, $176 million per year. Now, the total amount of trade through all of Afghanistan's border crossings, that needs to be looked at. Here's a map of that. The border crossings are the ones in the green. You can see them here and here. That's the ranch that I just talked about. You have one over here, Ten Gural, which is over there. And you have about four or five more. Now, these revenues are estimated to be $2 billion per year. So you can see the money generated there is quite a bit. Now, once informal trade is included, that figure is going to be actually twice as high. Well, at this point, Afghans are definitely very worried about the chain of events that happened in their country with the collapse of the government. The Afghan money is quickly losing its value, especially, for example, a neighboring country like Pakistan.
ये जो हालात बदल रहे दिन ब दिन पानी की जो पाकिस्तानी रुपीज़ है उसकी कदर बहुत कम हो चुका है हम लोगों ने काफ़ी नुकसान उठाया है क्योंकि कि तालिबान के आने की वजह से इतलात की वजह से पाकिस्तानी रुपये बढ़ गया और पानी जो है वो बहुत नीचे आ चुका है
Well, let's get some analysis into the picture. Our guest Phyllis Bennis joins us. She is from the Institute for Policy Studies. Phyllis Bennis is an American writer. She's an activist and a political commentator featured on many television stations. Her focus has been mainly on issues related to West Asia and the United Nations. She's also a very strong critic of Israel and the United States and a leading advocate of Palestinian rights. All right, Phyllis, welcome. Looking at the time that the U.S. actually invaded Afghanistan, the year 2001, up to now, $2.26 trillion to have been spent. The cost of war project at Brown University has calculated that. Now, this investment, if you want to call it that, has yielded a chaotic, humiliating end to America's longest war. What went wrong, Phyllis? Why is the Afghan government failing to deliver on its economic investments that were made by the U.S. or failed to do that and said to be rife with corruption and unfinished projects? I mean, after all, the U.S. spent $2 trillion there. And for what? That is the key question.
I think we have to recognize that the U.S. war in Afghanistan was always a kind of derivative war. It was a war of vengeance following the attacks of 9/11, despite the fact that none of the 9/11 hijackers were Afghan. They were Saudi and Egyptian. But the war was designed partly to keep up the level of tension in the United States, keep up U.S. support for a coming war in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Phyllis Bennis there. Okay. She obviously says that that was not a democratic exercise when it came to the U.S. At least that's not the way that it went down. All right. Our next piece now takes a look at the reasons behind this war, which was nothing short than a cash machine, especially for military contractors, as you're about to see.
It was one of the most revealing and shocking exposés to cover the U.S.-led Afghanistan war. Bold journalism, numerous testimonials, admissions too hard to swallow, revealing the truth about the Afghan war and the lies behind it. The Afghanistan Papers. U.S. officials constantly said they were making progress. They were not, and they knew it.
Thanks to our military, our allies, and the brave fighters of Afghanistan, the Taliban regime is coming to an end.
For many of you, this will be your last tour in Afghanistan. And by the end of this year, the transition will be complete, and Afghans will take full responsibility for their security, and our combat mission will be over.
To add salt to injury, the U.S. government did not even have an idea about the money splurged. No exact accounting done. But why? Maybe this revelation was the answer, made back in 2011, which is one of the pillars of the U.S. so-called empire.
Because the goal is not to completely subjugate Afghanistan. The goal is to use Afghanistan to wash money out of the tax bases of the United States, out of the tax bases of European countries, through Afghanistan, and back into the hands of a transnational security elite. That is the goal, i.e. the goal is to have an endless war, not a successful.
The Afghan president described the killings as unforgivable. An American soldier is in custody after a shooting rampage that's left 16 civilians, some women and children, dead in Afghanistan's southern Kandahar province.
A shocking expose out today in The Intercept reveals CIA-backed death squads in Afghanistan have killed children as young as 8 years old in a series of night raids, many targeting madrasas, Islamic religious schools.
And they dragged the two oldest-looking boys out of that room, took them into another room, along with 10 other older-looking students. But as you already discussed, some of them were as young as 8 or 9 years old.
One of the assets that Afghanistan has, which has become a focus, is its mineral wealth. And one country in particular which appears to have its eye on it is China. Here you see China receiving a member of the Taliban recently. Since the U.S. has now withdrawn itself from the country, China may be looking to back the Taliban with Afghan mining investments. Rare earth metals in Afghanistan were estimated to be worth anywhere between $1 trillion and $3 trillion in 2020. Only hours after the Taliban overran Afghanistan, a Chinese foreign ministry spokesman said that Beijing was ready for friendly cooperation with Afghanistan.
Afghan 经济社会发展提供帮助.
Well, our guest in this section, Marvin Weinbaum, joins us. He is scholar in residence at the Middle East Institute. He's also a professor emeritus of political science at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and served as analyst for Pakistan and Afghanistan in the U.S. Department of State's Bureau of Intelligence and Research from the years 1999 to 2003. Also rejoining us is Mohammad Daoud Abadi and Phyllis Bennis. Okay, Marvin, welcome. All those trillions of dollars, Afghanistan's still one of the smallest formal economies on the planet. Last year, President Ashraf Ghani said that 90% of the population was living on less than $2 a day. I mean, if the U.S. gave the money, the trillions of dollars away, the economy would be much larger. Why did this not translate to the Afghan economy?
Well, you know, a lot of it was lost through corruption. There's no question about that. This is something that the Afghans, as well as the international community, has some responsibility for. There were the resources to do far more, but again, I don't want to minimize the fact that there has been change, and along with everything that went wrong, there was a good deal that did go right.
Only the money that the U.S. invested in Afghanistan went to the people, but it didn't. I mean, Afghans living on less than $2 per day, 90% of them, I mean, that's incredible. What really happened here? I mean, there's aid money also that's involved. Donor conferences have produced billions of dollars in money every year, particularly since the invasion.
The money that was spent by the United States did not go to the people of Afghanistan. It went to a corrupt government that was put in place by the United States and that represented U.S. interests in maintaining their version of stability.
All right. Daoud, corruption, both from the U.S. and the Afghan side. You mentioned some of it before, unfinished projects, for example. We've talked about it. But why didn't the U.S. money and the aid money go to the Afghan people? Let's not forget billions were given to Afghanistan on a yearly basis. I'm sure you know that. Ordinary Afghans, however, did not reap the benefits. What happened there?
The reason it didn't translate into an Afghan economy was because there was no planning. There was no structure. There was no strategy for spending the money. The money was, in a way, given to all these corrupt officials to keep them keep their mouths shut.
All right. Well, let's look at another issue, and that's the mineral wealth of Afghanistan. Experts are saying it'll reap $1 trillion, the actual worth. And until now, the Taliban have not tapped into it. They have profited from opium and the heroin trade. How will the Taliban get to those resources, do you think, since it does not have the money, unless China becomes a partner in this, which it has said that it's willing to do so?
Well, I need to make a correction here. It is not $1 trillion, it is $3 trillion, according to the estimates given by the West. But let's not forget that that wealth belonged to the Taliban, to the Afghan people. The Taliban are Afghans, and that is their country, that's their wealth, and it's nobody's business how they want to use their money and how they don't want to use the money.
All right, we appreciate that. That's Mohammad Daoud there contributing to our program. Mohammad Daoud is a chairman of the Afghan Nation Peace Council and previously a spokesman and negotiator for the Hizb Islami Group. Okay, we'll be right back with my final thoughts. If the U.S. actually leaves the country alone and leaves it for good, as is, it is withholding the government money that's held abroad, $9 billion worth. Now, this will be disastrous for an economy with a new administration. But the story of Afghanistan could have began 20 years ago. And if the U.S. had not invaded and then occupied it, it would have been, at a minimum, better than the state that it is in today. Make no mistake, we are not here to promote, defend, nor demonize the Taliban. Iran has stated that it will be a partner in a country that is looking for peace and stability, and has spoken to Russia and China about that. After all, it makes sense. Iran wants a stable neighbor that it can do trade with. But is the U.S. involvement with the Taliban over, or will it use the group against China or Iran? Only time will tell. That does with this edition of Economic Divide. I'm Kavit Taghvi. It's good to have been with you. Until next time.
In the limelight.
The US-NATO's rhetorical game of nation-building and democracy-building, all while funding the very forces they were officially fighting in the so-called War on Terror, is one of the greatest deceptions of the last 20 years. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Javed Nawabi, writer. This article is published under the heading Afghanistan, the Great Deception. Stay tuned for the details of this article. How is it that 40 of the world's most developed countries involved in the US-NATO operation supposedly spent more in Afghanistan than they did in implementing the Marshall Plan in Western Europe, and yet somehow still systematically disregarded where that investment needed to go? If sincerely invested, this money would have gone toward building the central state's administrative capacity for social services and law and order, as well as the agricultural sector, since the vast majority of Afghanistan's population has lived in rural areas for the past 20 years, which is also, incidentally, the region from which the Taliban got most of their recruits. The World Bank estimates that 74% of Afghans live in rural areas, but that number is almost certainly an undercount due to the way in which its figures categorize rural residents who have only temporarily moved to cities. Instead, the agricultural sector was willfully neglected, which contributed to the high national unemployment rate of at least 40% in a country where about 70% of the population is under 25 years old. This is rather ironic when the United States and the European Union subsidize their own agricultural sectors, which make up not more than 5% of their national labor forces respectively, about $49 billion and $101 billion just in 2019. Meanwhile, in Afghanistan, a country with a total GDP of about $20 billion that they occupied for 20 years, they could not subsidize Afghan farmers enough in order to make the country food self-sufficient while creating jobs in the rural areas. The policies of the United States and NATO, because of its lukewarm commitment to the nation building, systematically undermined building Afghanistan's central state capacity by avoiding giving the majority of the reconstruction aid to the relevant ministries with the excuse that there wasn't sufficient capacity in the Afghan government to absorb the aid, for that there was corruption. However, the corruption was nurtured precisely because the majority of the reconstruction funds went to the U.S. private contractors, which then subcontracted the projects without proper accountability measures, with the end result being that 90% of the reconstruction aid took a round trip, finding its way back to U.S. private security firms, non-governmental organizations or NGOs, and U.S. Agency for International Development USAID contracts granted to U.S. corporations. Only 2% or less of U.S. spending actually reached the Afghan people in the form of basic infrastructure or poverty-reducing services. The showcasing of the so-called reconstruction investments with high visibility was a way to foster global perceptions about the generosity of U.S. NATO development projects, which in reality, they were building schools without students and teachers, power plants that were not usable, etc. Unfortunately, instead of appointing government officials based on merit and qualifications, the United States and NATO deliberately chose personnel of neoliberal, Ivy League technocrats and warlords, with their attendant foreign advisors leading the transition government that ultimately became an infestation of corruption run by NGOs and foreign consultants, with little to no state capacity being built. As the U.S.-owned Special Inspector General for Afghanistan's reconstruction, John Sopko, revealed, much of the reconstruction money in the name of Afghanistan was recklessly spent faster than it could be accounted for and properly monitored. For this reason, according to Sopko's report, the U.S. ultimately achieved the opposite of what it intended. It fueled corruption, delegitimized the government, and increased insecurity, hence providing the conditions for the resurgence of the Taliban to grow. The last couple of months of negotiations with the Taliban in Doha, Qatar, have further revealed that building a legitimate and professionally staffed Afghan central state with a productive economy for its tax base was never the true intention for Afghanistan, the West Asia region, or the Central Asia region. The US-NATO's rhetorical game of nation-building and democracy-building, all while funding the very forces they were officially fighting in the so-called war on terror, is one of the greatest deceptions of the last 20 years. The reality is that Afghanistan has become one more bucket list country in the Project for New American Century, or PNAC. And again, its women, children, elderly, and young will pay the biggest price. Hopefully, the world will awaken from the belief that the United States regime and NATO, with their shameful colonial legacy and their present neocolonial relations in Latin America, the Caribbean, the West Asia, North Africa region, Southeast Asia, and Africa, can actually bring peace, prosperity, and progress to the global South. This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.